Sims versus Acevedo. Ms. Morse?
Yes, go ahead, Ms. Morse.
May it please the court. I would like to highlight 2 points for the court today. The first is that Mr. Sims' federal habeas petition was timely. The second is that the state violated Brady v. Maryland. To the first point, I'd like to point out that the district court specifically noted in its opinion that Mr. Sims' federal petition was only 1 day late. So any 1 day in the entire time period that was told, that the district court erroneously found was not told, would make Mr. Sims' petition timely. Here, we'd like to focus on the first of 2 time periods that we point out in our briefs, and that period is in June of 2005. Mr. Sims submitted his state habeas petition over 3 weeks earlier than the district court found. The state court clerk erroneously rejected his petition when it had no discretion to do so. So Mr. Sims' petition is timely. Now to the Brady violation. Here we have serious violations of Brady v. Maryland. There were 3 witnesses that the state put on that presented false testimony. Moreover, there were critical documents, including police reports, that were withheld that would have shown that those witnesses' testimony to be false, or at the very least would have drawn their testimony into serious question. The first witness...
Yeah, we could have had a hearing on all this if he hadn't withdrawn the claim. And seems to me that's the end of the subject, isn't it?
Your Honor, it is not the end of the subject. Mr. Sims took his Brady claims through 1 full round of state review, and to the extent the court finds that there is procedural default when he subsequently withdrew his right to an evidentiary hearing on his Brady claims, that procedural default is overcome by a showing of cause and prejudice. Here there was very good cause for Mr. Sims to withdraw his right to an evidentiary hearing because the state promised that it would again seek the death penalty after Mr. Sims had already been pardoned by ex-Governor Ryan. Here, it was a Hobson's choice, and really no choice at all, between the renewed possibility of the death penalty and discontinuing.
Well, he withdrew it to save his commutation, didn't he?
Pardon?
I say he withdrew this claim in order to save the commutation of his sentence.
He did withdraw his claims. However, that's not the law in Illinois now. It was unclear at the time, back in July of 2004, what the law in Illinois would be. The Illinois courts had not yet interpreted Governor Ryan's order and what the effect would be on petitioners like Mr. Sims. And the state erroneously told Mr. Sims that it would again seek the death penalty, which it cannot. And so Mr. Sims withdrew his claims. That's good cause, and according to the test laid out in Crivens v. Roth, it meets that test, and so his claims for Brady, his Brady violations survive.
To go back to the procedural, the initial statute of limitations issue, I don't understand why, what difference does it make whether the clerk rejected his submission or filed it? What's the difference between rejection and filing?
Your Honor, according to the law in Illinois, there is no difference.
Right.
For purposes of tolling Section 2244.
I don't understand that.
So what we've laid out in our papers, and this is the law, in Illinois, there is a pro-mailing policy. Petitions are deemed
look,
filed.
Here's what I don't understand. I think we now in the federal courts have a rule that clerks are not supposed to reject, unless there's an order by the court, they're not supposed to reject filings, however preposterous the filings are. They're supposed to file them in so that there's a document in the records of the court. But that doesn't mean it's a valid document, right? So the fact that someone submits a postage stamp and says, you know, this is my petition for rehearing or something like that, that doesn't toll anything. So I don't see how an informa pauperis application that contains no information about indigence tolls anything.
The record shows that Mr. Sims did submit an informa pauperis application.
But he didn't have the information about it, about his assets, right?
It did have information about he alleged that he was a poor person, that he was unable to pay. It's but respondent's didn't, position.
He didn't give his prison account or whatever you're supposed to do. So it's rejected. It could be filed in, but the fact that it was filed in wouldn't mean that it would toll anything. So that's a completely separate issue. What tolls? How complete must your filing be in order to toll, right?
That's true. His filing must comply with the Illinois state rules, and it did. The state court clerk erroneously...
It did in the sense that I think, maybe I'm wrong, I thought it complied in the sense that he should have accepted for filing, but that didn't mean that it was a valid form of pauperis affidavit.
Well, the whether or not the informa pauperis application should be accepted is a decision for the court, and we know that from the Illinois statute, it's 55105D that says that. But the clerk has no discretion to reject the petition out of hand.
That's fine. He files it in, but as I say, if it's not valid, why would it toll anything?
It was valid, and I just want to make clear for the court that there's
a... holds that, yes, it should have been filed, but it wasn't an adequate affidavit. Is it clear that nevertheless, because it should have been filed or should have been accepted for filing, it tolled the statute of limitations?
Your Honor, it would have tolled the statute of limitations had it been properly accepted for filing. And then the statute of limitations would have stopped filing when it was rejected. However, I'd like to point out that there's a difference between the local filing rule and the Illinois state rules. The local rule cannot impose an additional requirement, which is the showing of exigent circumstances and the trust account and all of that. That's Administrative Order 97.
His affidavit was adequate?
We are saying that his affidavit was adequate, that he submitted an informa pauperis affidavit when he originally submitted his petition in June of 2005, and that the clerk had no discretion to refuse to accept it for filing.
You keep talking about the clerk. Would you answer my question? Was that a valid informa pauperis application?
Yes, he did submit a valid informa pauperis application. It's respondent's position that there's an affidavit that was also submitted that was notarized on June 7, and that was the IFP application, and that it's insufficient. It's our position that he submitted an additional document that was the IFP application, and that it was sufficient. So respondent is trying to confuse the record.
So that's the issue: the sufficiency of the
documents.
Affidavit, not whether it should have been filed.
I think that both issues are present. I'd like to just briefly touch on the Brady violations, if I might. I'd like to just point out that there are serious violations here, that Ms. Matas lied when she said she identified Mr. Sims without hesitation, and Detective Mueller also lied. And Mr. Mogavero later admitted that was promised consideration from the state. I see I've entered my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Morris. Mr. Blankenheim?
Thank you very much, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Michael Blankenheim on behalf of the respondent. This Court should affirm the District Court's judgment because the petition was untimely. And petitioner is not entitled to statutory tolling for either of the two periods he seeks, and he's not entitled to equitable tolling either. I'd like to turn to Judge Posner's question regarding the sufficiency of the affidavit. In this case, the state trial court clerk rejected petitioner's original submission of his state habeas complaint for three reasons. First, there was no filing fee attached. Second, there was no showing of why the prepayment of the fee should be excused. And third, petitioner failed to attach a copy of his inmate trust fund account. Now, under Section 2244D2, petitioner is entitled
to... Of course, this clerk who is has got discretion whether to accept or not to accept, hasn't he?
The clerk...
There's no law that says he has to reject the petition because of those deficiencies.
The clerk would be obligated to...
You're giving the clerk an awful lot of power here, it seems to me, if you're saying, well, if you reject it, that's it, and this guy is out of luck.
Well, under Section 2244D2, the petitioner is entitled to statutory tolling only when he has a properly filed complaint for state collateral relief pending.
No, but you're leaving that decision in the hands of the whoever's in the clerk's office that receives the petition.
And we know under Section 2244D2 that how the state court treats the application binds the federal habeas court for purposes of statutory tolling. And in Pace, the Supreme Court expressly rejected the distinction that petitioner seeks to draw in this case between filing conditions that are enforced by clerks and filing conditions such as timeliness that are enforced by judges. And again, so the question of whether the clerk's decision was correct under Illinois law does not factor into the Section 2244D2 calculus. However, it may factor into the equitable tolling calculus if a complaint should have been filed and it's unambiguous that the state court clerk erred in refusing to file it, that might show an extraordinary circumstance beyond the petitioner's control. But in this case, petitioner's briefs, he does not dispute that the informa pauperis application he submitted to the state trial court clerk is insufficient because it's not notarized. And that document can be found as an exhibit to document 15 in the record, which is petitioner's response to our motion to dismiss. And petitioner claims that he originally submitted that application to the state trial court clerk with his first state habeas submission. However, there's no evidence in the record to show that. And the clerk's letter, which can be found at page 12 of the petitioner's supplemental appendix, tends to rebut that claim, since she cites the petitioner's failure to attach or to show why prepayment of the fee should be excused. And again, petitioner says, yes, I did submit an informa pauperis application, and that's, again, at page 11 of document 15 in the record. But again, that affidavit is insufficient because it's not notarized, and petitioner does not dispute that under Illinois law, an affidavit is invalid unless it's notarized. And since the state trial court clerk was entitled to reject that complaint, petitioner cannot show that her refusal to file it was an extraordinary circumstance that would warrant equitable tolling. Judge Kudahe, you noted that with respect to the Brady claim, petitioner's strategic decision to withdraw that claim from consideration by the Illinois courts is the end of the matter, and that's correct. But there's an additional procedural obstacle that petitioner has to overcome to have his claim heard in federal court, and that is his failure to plead that claim in his federal habeas petition. The petition is clear, or petitioner demonstrates in the petition that he knows the difference between the section that asks him to list the claims that he had raised in state court during post-conviction review and the grounds he raises for federal habeas relief. In the petition, he lists all 20 claims that he presented to the Illinois Supreme Court on post-conviction review, but in the section where he's asked to plead each ground for federal habeas relief, he raises only 6 of those claims, and the Brady claim is not among them. And so for that reason, the claim is forfeited, and even if it were included in the petition, it's procedurally defaulted, given petitioner's strategic decision to withhold that claim from consideration by the Illinois courts to preserve the benefit of his commuted sentence. I'd also like to discuss the district court's finding that petitioner was not entitled to equitable tolling. That decision is reviewed by this court for an abuse of discretion, and petitioner cannot show that the district court abused its discretion in denying tolling in this case. First, the district court found that petitioner failed to pursue his rights diligently, based primarily on the fact that petitioner allowed the first 11 months of the statutory period to expire without taking any action in pursuit of his rights. Petitioner's response to that is, well, I made a mistake in my understanding of Illinois law, believing that I could not file my state habeas complaint until I was entitled, until the legal portion of my sentence had expired. That legal mistake does not cut against the district court's lack of diligence finding, again, which is subject to review for clear error. First, to excuse the district court's lack of diligence finding on that basis would sap this court's decision in Williams versus Sims of much of its effect. Williams holds that legal mistakes of, or even reasonable mistakes of law, do not support equitable tolling. And second, the district court's finding that the 11 months that petitioner allowed to expire should be held against him is important in the equitable tolling context, because equitable tolling is an extraordinary remedy that should be available to petitioners who have been diligently pursuing their rights and only need the remedy because of some kind of extraordinary circumstance beyond his control that prevented a timely filing. But here, the reason petitioner needs equitable tolling is because of his failure to act sooner, not because of any extraordinary circumstances beyond his control. Just as importantly, petitioner cannot show that anything actually prevented a timely filing. In this case, even assuming that the state court clerk should have accepted his complaint, or if the state court clerk erred by refusing to file the state habeas complaint until July 1st, that filing told the clock with 1 week left on the federal statute of limitations. And thereafter, the clock remained tolled for the ensuing 16 months and 28 days. Petitioner identifies no obstacle or impediment that would have prevented a filing at that time. And also what is important is that this court's precedent and the Supreme Court in Pace provided that, at that time, if there's any kind of procedural uncertainty regarding a filing in state court, the petitioner's remedy is to file a protective petition in federal habeas petition. So in this case, when petitioner receives the clerk's letter informing him that his petition hadn't been filed, he cannot be sure that the clock was tolled during those 3 weeks from June 7, 2005 to June 30th. And at that point, he should have filed, and he could have filed, a federal habeas petition. He simply did not.
Wait, now, what's the relation between the 3 weeks and the 16 months that you mentioned?
Once the clerk accepted his state habeas complaint on July 1st of 2005, he then had state habeas proceedings were pending for the next 16 months and 28 days. So that significantly offsets the 3 weeks of untold time that he lost between the June 7th.
Are you suggesting he should have done something during those 16 months?
We're suggesting that he could have filed a federal habeas petition at that time, a protective petition, to ensure his entitlement to seek federal review of his claims. And this court's decisions in Powell and Brooks versus Walls show that when the petitioner makes a choice to proceed only with a state court litigation, when it's available to him to pursue a federal protective petition, he can't be said to have been prevented from filing on time.
What case is that?
Brooks versus Walls and Powell versus Davis. And if the court has no further questions, we'd ask that this court affirm the district court's judgment.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Morse?
Just three quick points on rebuttal, Your Honor. The first is that the district court specifically found that it was just because of the local rules that the state habeas petition was rejected. You can find that in our attached appendix on page A7 in the district court's opinion, and they found specifically that it was because of his prison trust fund account. Now, Illinois law specifically says that the clerk has no discretion to refuse to accept his petition when it complies with state rules. And this court is not bound by a state court clerk's error. The second point is that the claim for Brady v. Maryland is not forfeited, just as claims in an appendix cannot be ignored, as the United States Supreme Court found in Dye v. Hoffbauer. Claims that are in other portions of a petition, such as the wrong section, as respondent's position is, cannot be ignored either. And the final point is that Powell v. Davis does not stand for the position that I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I've lost my place. We just would ask that the court find that Mr. Sims' petition is timely, and that the court find that he's made a colorable showing of constitutional violations, and grant him an evidentiary hearing on these issues.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Morris. You were appointed, were you not? So
we were.
We're grateful for your efforts on behalf of the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.